We have our prophet study. We are covering 2 Kings, as most of you are aware of that. We've been going through it for quite some time now. We have reached 2 Kings chapter 11. Before we go into this chapter, recall there's some details that to refresh your memory what's been going on in this part of 2 Kings. We're discussing the extermination of the house of Ahab. But before we get there, we'll open up the prayer.
Almighty God, our Father in heaven, thank you for your time you've given to us. For each Shabbat, each week, we see your gifts of kindness, of love, and compassion. Father, we ask you to continue to help us to grow, to be wise, useful servants to you. Teach us well, that we teach and show anyone you give to us what is true and right. Help us to be fair, Father, to be kind and loving. We ask for your wisdom, and opening our eyes and our ears. In Yeshua's name, amen.
We are in 2 Kings chapter 11. To give you a heads up what's going on, in chapter 10 we covered 2 weeks ago, I believe it was. Jehu was the new commander, now became the new king of the northern Israel. He's going through, he had killed off all of Ahab's descendants in Israel, and quite a number of them that came from Judah up there at that moment in time, as God saw fit. And he is fulfilling out the job that God commanded him. Well, as you know, Jehu was king of northern Israel, not the king of Judah. So anything south of the border, he doesn't touch. We're going to cover that today. We're in 2 Kings chapter 11. When Athaliah, Ahaziah's mother, saw that her son had died, she arose and exterminated all the offspring of the royal family. But Jehosheba, King Jehoram's daughter, Ahaziah's sister, took Joash, son of Ahaziah, and smuggled him from the midst of the king's sons who were being killed, and put him and his nursemaid in the bedchamber. They hid him from Athaliah, so he was not put to death. He remained with her in the temple of the Lord, hidden for 6 years, while Athaliah reigned over the land. In the 7th year, Jehoiada sent for and took the captains of hundreds who were over the mighty man and the foot soldiers. He brought them to meet with him in the temple of the Lord. He made a covenant with them and adjured them in the temple of the Lord, and he showed them the king's son. He commanded them, saying, "This is what you are to do. A third of those who are arriving on the Shabbat will be in charge of the watch of the king's palace. A third will be stationed at the sewer gate. A third will be stationed at the gate behind the infantry. Be careful to keep the watch of the palace diligently. The other two groups among you will be joined by all those who are leaving on the Shabbat. They shall keep the guard of the temple of the Lord for the king. You will thus encircle the king all around, each man with his weapon in hand. Any outsider who breaks into your ranks shall be put to death. You must remain with the king when he goes out and when he comes in." So the captains of hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada the Cohen had commanded them. Each took his men, those who were arriving on the Shabbat and those who were leaving on the Shabbat, and came to Jehoiada the Cohen. The Cohen gave the captains of hundreds the spear arsenal and the shields of King David, which were in the temple of the Lord. The infantry stood, each man with his weapon in hand, from the right flank of the temple to the left flank of the temple, near the altar and the sanctuary, surrounding the king. Then he brought out the king's son and placed the crown and the divine testimony upon him. They declared him king and anointed him, and they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king!" Athaliah heard the sound of the people who were rushing, and she came to the people of the temple of the Lord. She looked, and there was the king standing at the place in the royal manner, with the officers and trumpets next to the king, and all the people of the land rejoicing and blowing trumpets. Athaliah tore her garments and shouted, "A rebellion! A rebellion!" Jehoiada the Cohen commanded the captains of hundreds and the officers of the force and said to them, "Take her away, but keep her with inside the ranks of the guards. Anyone who comes after her, kill the sword." The Cohen had said, "Let her not be put to death in the temple of the Lord." They made a place for her, and she came by the way of the horse's entrance to the palace of the king. And there she was put to death. Jehoiada then sealed the covenant between the Lord and the king, and spoke, and the people, and spoke, people to be a people of the Lord. And between the king and the people, all the people of the land came to the temple of Baal and tore it down. They smashed its altars and images. Matan, the priest of Baal, they slew in front of the altars. The Kohen then appointed ministers over the temple of the Lord. He took the captains of hundreds, the mighty men, the infantry, and all the people of the land, and they escorted the king down to the temple of the Lord. They proceeded by way of the gate of the infantry to the royal palace, and he sat on the royal throne. The entire people of the land rejoiced, and the city was tranquil, for they had put Athaliah to death by the sword in the king's palace. My chapter 11, by the way, ends there. It does not include your verse 21. That's in my chapter 7, or chapter 12. Now, 2 Kings, chapter 11. Any questions or comments I can talk to or answer for you about this particular chapter? It's relatively straightforward. It's pretty obvious what's going on. Does anybody recall what's going on? What had happened?
A rebellion, yes.
A rebellion did occur. Do you remember what I spoke about the last time I was up here, 2 weeks ago? Do you recall what the topic was? It was contrasting two men. Do you know who the two men were? Do you recall? Jehu, the guy up north, and the other one. It was recorded in Jeremiah as well. Jehonadab. Jehu and Jehonadab. Now, do you remember what the details were that was distinguishing these two particular men? This is chapter 10, by the way, of 2 Kings. That's right, awful again. Okay, so, this is chapter 11, but to back up just a hair on chapter 10, there were two men contrasted, Jehu and his friend, Jehonadab.
Yeah.
What was the difference between the two of them? They were both good men. They both did what their job was. What was Jehu's? Jehu was the new king, and his job was to exterminate all the men of Ahab, all males in particular of Ahab. Jehonadab was also a good man, was given no such assignment, but he was so righteous that when Jehu met him and saw him in the field as he was traveling along, he asked, Jehonadab, are you with me or against me? And I said, I'm with you, this is great. He got up on his chariot and they went through and they killed Ahab's descendants. The whole temple was torn down, he made a fake sacrifice and all the Baal priests were killed. Jehonadab was distinguished 250 years later by God. God said, the descendants of Jehonadab, because you have obeyed your father's voice for these 250 years, though he spoke to you once, you've obeyed him, as a result, you'll be preserved. Your line preserved forever. You will never fail to have a man stand before me as long as you exist. That was Jehonadab's line. Jehu, for all of his reward, he got only 4 generations will be king, and then he'll be exterminated, which he was. What was the distinction? What was so unique about Jehonadab and Jehu that God blessed Jehonadab immensely and Jehu only a little bit? Jehu did a mediocre job.
But half
the job. Not even quite. It was sort of a third of the job. The third of the job, as far as his job, was to exterminate Ahab. And he did that. Good job. Well, one could argue maybe it's half. It's hard to say. But in the process, he also exterminated Baal worship in northern Israel. That was it. He did nothing for the Jeroboam's two calves, the new gods, the new sequence, the new holy days they were all observing. He maintained those because he liked them. He did nothing for the Asherah trees or the high places, all the other stuff that was still going on, the pagan worship in all of northern Israel. He maintained that. He liked that. So that he failed to do any of that part. Jehonadab, on the other hand, when the opportunity arose and said, hey, it's time to kill Ahab and his descendants, Jehonadab, knowing full well what God wanted, was an obedient follower of God, very unique individual, joined in to the extermination of Ahab. And God blessed him forever. God blessed Jehu for 4 generations. That was it. That's what's going on in the previous chapter. This chapter, as Jehu has finished off his jobs in northern Israel, we have Judah has now come on the scene, because Judah obviously is not under Jehu's command. He has very little influence happens in there. Obviously, people can go back and forth, but as a king or a military officer, he cannot do so. So when God said to Jehu, exterminate all the males of Ahab, how is Jehu going to kill all the males of Ahab that living in Judah? How does he do that? Well, he did Tower of Babel. That was in Israel, though. If I'm in Israel, this is Jehu in Israel. So let's pretend, I'll draw a little map here. A basic Israel, forgive me if I'm out of scale. Close like that. The little line here. So Jehu's up here in Israel. He has full command up there. Jerusalem's down here. This is all Judah. Now, the agreement that Elisha, actually God gave to Elijah originally, but it went through to Elisha to do the process, Elijah's assistant, to anoint Jehu. The agreement was that Jehu had to kill all, as the Bible quoted, any who pee against a wall of the house of Ahab. So all males, including animals. Any male, the house of Ahab, who can, quote, pee against a wall, as the Bible uses the word, that must die. Well, Jehu had a great opportunity at the time. A large contingent from Judah that were descendants of Ahab happened to be traveling north while Jehu was traveling south. And they met each other and he killed a whole bunch of them right there, 42 of them. But how does he get all the descendants of Ahab that are currently in Judah? Does anybody recall why they're descendants of Ahab in Judah? Some of you are relatively new, so let's do a miniaturized family tree. I'll erase this and come back to it later. So there's Ahab, and with Jezebel, I'll just read with Jay. He has a whole bunch of kids, 70 sons. Not all with the same woman, but he has 70 sons. I don't know how many wives he had, but I'm sure she didn't birth every single one of them. He has 70 sons and a number of daughters. One of his daughters is Athaliah. I'll just abbreviate. Ahab's contemporary in Judah was Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat had lots of sons. One in particular named Jehoram. That Jehoram, by the way, Ahab also has a son named Jehoram. Don't get him confused. A little abbreviate J. So this Jehoram got married to this woman, Athaliah, by Jehoshaphat's thing. Oh, it's a great idea. A good, you know, whatever family tree thing going on. So Athaliah and this Jehoram have kids. One particular kid is Ahaziah. Ahaziah is a young man. This Jehoram was an awful person. God killed him. Ahaziah comes up, and this Jehoram, however, at the same time, becomes king of Israel, while this one is king of Judah at the time. This Jehoram, God kills. This Ahaziah comes and visits this Jehoram up here, because they're fighting in a town called Ramoth-Gilead. At that time, this Jehoram is shot with an arrow. He flees to Jezreel. Read with Jezreel. And that's where Jehu comes, finds him, kills him, kills Ahaziah as well, because Ahaziah's with him at the time, kills Jezebel, wipes out all the sons of Ahab and Jezreel, as well as in Samaria. Read it for Sam. So anybody who is in Judah, which are descendants of Athaliah, which means Ahaziah, all of her other children she has, however many there are, any of his children, he has children, which means obviously grandchildren to her, any other, I don't know how many children she actually had, so obviously Ahaziah is one of them. How many she had, we don't know. So all of his children are also, they're all living down here in the territory of Judah. So how does God get Jehu to kill the house of Ahab in Judah? Many of them did, but not all of them. So how does he do it? He doesn't. He lets Athaliah do it. Evil doesn't like other things. So Jehu was given the assignment, and he did everything that he could to kill off Ahab's family. Good job. He could not go down into southern to Judah to do it. So what does God do? He lets Ahab's daughter do it for him. Athaliah's mother, when she saw that her son, Ahaziah, had died, she arose and exterminated all the offspring of the royal family. So what did that accomplish? It made her queen, but what specifically did it accomplish in God's eyes? Got rid of every male offspring of the descendants of Ahab, everyone who, quote, quote, pee against the wall, is now dead. So God used Jehu to clean up Israel, and he used Ahab's own daughter to clean up Judah. Pretty impressive, actually. Because God used an evil person to do his will. We don't like thinking that, but it's true. He can use evil to do his own will because evil is evil. And he knows what evil will like to do. So make evil do evil against something else that's also evil. And guess what? One of them's going to die. One of them's going to lose. So that's how God took care of it. Brilliant. Of course, he's good at that. He usually is pretty brilliant. So he allowed an evil individual to kill off her own offspring and all of Ahab's offspring to become the new queen. Because she wanted the royal family. Now, what was her objective? What would make her want to do that? Power is a big deal for a lot of people. And in particular for her. Remember her mom, Jezebel? What was Jezebel known for? Massive power and killing of other people. That's what she did. I'm going to erase this because this thing else went right up here. Jehoshaphat. What do you guys remember about Jehoshaphat? Was he a good king or a bad king? He was a good king. What was one of the good things he did? Can you name anything? Any good thing he did? I erased my map too, because I don't need it either. Can you name one good thing Jehoshaphat did? Well, here's one thing he did. This is no particular order. I'm not really seeing everything he did, just one of the things he did. He taught. That was one of his major things. He taught all the people of Judah, and he set up his sons, he set up the priesthood, he did everything he could, and spread them out through Judah to teach the ordinary people about God. That's impressive. No other king before him did that. But that was one of his major pushes. He wanted to make sure that everyone was taught well. And he had many sons too. I don't remember the exact number. I've forgotten. Chapter 7 or 8, I think, of 2 Kings. Many sons he had. He distributed them all throughout the land of Judah. So I'm going to draw up Judah here again, my little map, slightly blown up. He had sons literally everywhere, because he wanted to make sure that everything was evenly distributed when he died. That this son down here would not be jealous of this one over here or this one over there of having rulership. No, they were more acting like governors. That was what he wanted to set up. Smart man. Smart man. He knew what to do. However, his son Jehoram, who he married off to Athaliah, had different ideas in his mind. So he's here in Jerusalem after Jehoshaphat dies. Jehoram goes off and he executes all of his brothers. Every single one of them. No exceptions. Is he a good man or not? He would not be a good man. And that's who Athaliah is married to. Now, one could argue whether she pushed him to do it or not. I won't say. But two peas in a pod tends to do the same things. So she has a similar mentality thought that he did. So if he was an exterminator of his own brothers to avoid a, quote, a contentious rulership, she exterminating her own grandchildren doesn't seem like that far of a stretch. Just say. Okay. So that's who she is. That's where we're dealing with and the type of individual we're dealing with. But insect world, there probably is. I think actually honeybee queens will do that too. They'll kill off any other contemporaries too. But that's, I'm not saying that Athaliah is a bug. Maybe she is, but I'm not saying she's a bug. You can learn a lot from God's creation, that's true. So that's where we're at. That's what's happening in the family of the northern tribes and the southern tribes, and how the kingship and queenship now is mounting up. So Athaliah is now the queen. Now, as it points out in verse 2, Yehosheba, King Jehoram's daughter. Now, I don't know if this is Athaliah's daughter as well or not, because as we already discussed, King Ahab had multiple wives in order to have 70 sons alone. I don't think Jezebel gave birth to all 70 men. We don't know how many wives King Jehoram had of Judah. So we don't know if this is his full-blood sister or just a half-sister, same father, different mothers. I don't know. Probably not the same mother. Just, you know, going out on the limb there, but probably not. Because she actually obeys God. So Ahaziah's sister took Joash, son of Ahaziah, and smuggled him from the midst of the king's sons who were being killed. Now, in 2 Chronicles chapter 23, this is recorded as well. This whole event, this whole chapter is recorded as well. A few extra details are given, but not many. In 2 Chronicles, the particular word used, by the way, for the extermination, in verse 1 it says exterminate all the offspring of the royal family. The particular word is actually a plague. Which, in tradition, I won't say right or wrong, when somebody administers a plague to another person, we call that poisoning. That's usually the process it's called. It's poisoning. So whatever method she chose to kill all of them, poison apparently is one of the methods. So all of her grandsons and whoever being descendants from Ahaziah were all in the process of being poisoned. So she hid him. And I want to say that because she was able to hide him. You see, imagine for a moment, you are Athaliah, you have command of the royal guard, and you see royal guard, there's the house. Here's a list of all the names of all the children in the house. Kill every one of them. The royal guards will likely go through each room. There's a pretty good chance, because they're royal guards, they know every room, they're going to go through every room. So how is it that Joash was able to be hidden in the bedchamber? The royal guards couldn't figure that out? Oh, look, there's a bedroom. Oh, but let's not go in that one. That's not likely to happen. However, if she was doing it not through that method of a mass killing via the sword, but rather a poisoning process, that is far more subtle, quieter, less noticed, because, keep in mind, she is a foreign queen. She's not a blood relative of any descendants of David, nor is she from Judah at all. She has no, quote, Israelite blood in her, in a quote, other than Ahab, which is, you know, weak at best. So if she went and sent the order to guards to kill off the line of David, would she then instigate? She'd be instigating a rebellion, because everyone in Judah knows the descendants of David are promised by God to be kings. So she runs the risk, if she orders a mass execution of all these sons by all the soldiers, she owes a risk of them turning around her and saying no, and killing her instead. Because, obviously, they are not necessarily followers of to the nth degree, I won't say that, but they do want to comprehend who God is, and they comprehend who David was. So just killing off the sons is not quite so simple if she does it publicly. Doing it more private, as 2 Chronicles seems to imply, makes more sense. Because after the sons are all dead, when she looks at the guards and say, oh look, they're all dead, what are they going to do? Kill her? Well, who's going to take the throne? Now it doesn't matter anymore. All lines of David are dead. All the royal heirs of David are dead. So there's no one to replace her. So now it doesn't matter anymore. So it's a subtle way of going the back door, of making your point, or getting the queenship. The word isn't a brilliant lady. She's devious. That's the right word. Devious lady. What the right word was. So that was her method. I won't say she poisoned necessarily every single one of them, but that was at least amongst her methods. At least the 2 Chronicles records it. Excuse me. So, in verse 3, obviously the child is hidden for 6 years in the temple of the Lord. Now, we just got to the Torah reading. You recall what the Torah was in the Torah reading, my father pointed out, in the temple of meeting? What did he say? Who did he say doesn't get to live in there? Priest doesn't get to live there. So in the tabernacle, I'm going to abbreviate because I'm a bad speller. Tabernacle, no one lives there, only God. And the high priest gets to visit. That's it. In the temple, however, how many of you recall, when we discussed this a couple years ago, I think it was, what Solomon's temple looked like? What is in the temple that's not in the tabernacle? Rooms, a whole bunch of them. The temple had three stories, and there were rooms all built inside the walls. The walls had various dimensions, the third story being the narrowest of the other two. Solomon was brilliant in his designer. So he had, the first story was obviously the ground floor. Second story was just a hair smaller, and it kept getting smaller and smaller until he reached the top story. So all these rooms are in each, and that's on the entire temple wall, all on the outside. It had little windows, yada yada, I'm not going through all of it. So the Holy of Holies, the sacred temple area location, was in the middle toward the back, which you could only see in it through the top, because it had no roof, if you were in the third story on the back room. Theoretically. I'm not saying we actually did, but just say you could. Unlike the tabernacle, people weren't allowed to live there. However, the temple wasn't built that way. These were all business-type storerooms. They were also residential rooms. Did everybody get to live there? No. Not everybody gets to live inside the temple. Who gets to live inside the temple? The priest, the one who's serving at the time, and any of the immediate quarters needed for the Levites in their service. Note in verse, where is it? Two flanks, weapon, watch gate, third gate, and verse, well, maybe verse 5 all the way through till verse, 8 or 9. It discusses the exchanging of the people. So Levi, by the way, Levites were the ones who were doing the exchanging job. They are the guards, they're the various people who work in this business, this place. The high priest stays there all the time. That's his family's residence. How many women go into the temple? Not many. Some, but not many. How many women get to live there? Even less get to live there than get to go in. So, other person who gets to live there, name one woman who you know gets to live there. The high priest's wife. His family stays there. I'm not saying he's this particular room, forgive me, I'm just circling it. He could be in any one of the rooms. Whatever room he chose or was there, that was there. So, he gets to live there. So his wife gets to live there. Hence, that boy gets to live in there for 6 years and no one know it. How do you hide a child for 6 years? I have four. They don't hide well. They get big, they get loud, they get doing stuff. Unless you're in an area that no one goes. Well, what area would that be? The high priest's quarters and other Levites who may know about it in the same location. Well, I don't know how many he told, it doesn't matter, but how many there were, they were there. And they were there, not only that, because they were serving the temple, were they loyal to Athaliah at all? No. So does he have any risk of them leaking the information? No. She is a worshiper of Baal and everything else that she decides to worship. The people inside of here didn't do such things. They're, I wouldn't say better educated, but they were better disciplined in what they were doing. And they're obeying God. That's what they did. That's what they do. So, this is what the temple looks like. Well, not exactly, but this is a sketch of what it would look like. Of what's happening and how she was able to how to hide there for 6 years. So there's a difference between the tabernacle and temple, their design. So the rules were different. Now that is not to say that anybody got to go into the Holy of Holy area in the temple. No, that was still high priest territory only. So there's nothing changes there. But what happens inside the walls is distinctly different than what happens inside the courtyards. There's also other chambers and gates and things like that, which I'm not going to discuss just yet. That's for in a few minutes. So I'm going to erase this, because I don't need it anymore. She's able to hide the child for 6 years, excuse me, up into the seventh year. Forgive me. Let's see here. So in the seventh year, Jehoiada sent and took the captains of hundreds, who were mighty men and foot soldiers. He brought them to with him, the temple of the Lord. He made a covenant with them, adjured them in the temple, which means he made them swear to God, essentially, which you're not supposed to normally do, but these particular individuals, these particular captains, are not just ordinary men. So we'll discuss who they are. Second Chronicles records them, who they actually are. He makes them swear they will not tell, basically not tell anybody, and he shows them the king's son. Now, everybody is assuming all the descendants of David, the royal heirs, that is, are all dead. Everybody believes that. No one thinks otherwise. So the fact that they get to see a son, he says, this is who the son actually is, they now have a hope. Wait a minute. Now, if we get rid of the woman, we actually have someone to replace the throne. But before that, there is no reason to bother killing her off, because there's no one to take the throne. What's the point? Kill her so you can put somebody else on her, maybe worse or better, who knows? It doesn't matter. So don't do it. They left her alone. So this time, he now has an heir. Now, excuse me, who these men were. In 2 Chronicles, records a little bit better, because this, in 2 Kings, it's a slightly more ambiguous as to who the men actually are. 2 Chronicles 23. They are not ordinary men. Okay. So, the 2 Chronicles 23, verse 1. In the seventh year of Jehoiada, he strengthened himself and made a covenant with the captains of hundreds. Azariah, the son of Jeroham, Ishmael, son of forgive these guys' names. Jehohanan, Azariah, son of Obed, and Maaseh, son of Adah. And Elishaphat, son of Zikri. And they went through Judah and gathered the Levites from all the cities of Judah and the chief fathers of Israel, and they came to Jerusalem. The congregation made a covenant with the king, the house of God. He said, behold, the king's son shall reign, as the Lord has said, the sons of David. And then, of course, goes through the details of what they're going to do. So who do they gather? The Levites from all the cities of Judah and the chief fathers of Israel. So who's there? Who's Jehoiada talking to? Levites. And the chiefs, or chief fathers. Two different groups of men. They have two different, very similar, but distinct functions. Levites, as... what was your name again? Mark. Pointed out, Levites serve God. Chiefs are commanders of the armies. And who do they serve? The king. By the way, for those of you, I'm not trying to be sexist, are queens allowed to be reigning over any of the men, people, children, whatever, of Israel? No. It's males. Males are the Torah rule. The king, not queen. So, all these chief fathers, they have a Torah-given assignment, whether they like it or not, to not be loyal to the queen. That is their assignment according to the Bible. By the way, that is in Deuteronomy. Not specifically says, you know, thou shalt, you know, disobey the queen, but specifically saying that what is allowed to be in kings are the ones who are to be not queens. I'm not saying it's something that's a women. It has nothing to do with that. It's what God commanded. By the way, he is a quote, calls himself a king. Yes.
This is politics, right?
It is like politics. You're right. It is. It's a coup. That's what this whole thing is. So the king's fathers, the chief fathers, serve the king. The Levites serve God. So who exchanges themselves every Shabbat? The priests do. David set that up. So I'm going to erase this again because I don't need it anymore. So the Levites... how do we spell that? I'll abbreviate for L. I am a worst speller than I know. Except my father. He spells worse. But that's that doesn't count. I'll tape that. Time. So Levites are usually every... okay, here's the detail that the Bible is a little bit ambiguous about. Whether this happens every single Shabbat or every other Shabbat. The Bible doesn't tell us. In 1 Chronicles chapter 24, David broke up all the priests and all the Levites into 24 groups. He divvied up the entire year allotted to these 24 groups. Each group took at least 2 weeks out of the year. Now, we don't know if the weeks were back-to-back weeks or divvied up, you know, halfway through the year. Who knows? It doesn't record that. whatever the breakup is, this particular Shabbat that Yehoiada is talking about is an exchange week, which means the Levites who are assigned to guard the temple, it's one large group. But Jehoiada is breaking them up into three sets. Three different tasks. These Levites are servants, they're also soldiers too. These particular Levites carry weapons, as well as all the instruments required to do God's will. Because their job, as according to David, was given to them, to guard the temple. That was their job, to guard it. Why does the temple need guarding? Isn't God there? Doesn't God guard it himself? Yes, Alma.
Guard it from, not from God, but to guard, to keep, to take care of the people that they won't die.
In some ways, yes, they do take care of the people. And it's told to you in verse 6, a third being stationed at the Sur gate. I'll talk about the Sur gate in a minute. That tells how what that gate is used for and who's doing what and what their function is at that gate, what the guard's function is. So they have function to guard the temple. It's not the guarding for, say, that, you know, some bad thing, whatever. It's something to get in there. It's the point is to guard it from contamination. Because if you recall when Aaron and his four sons, time before two were killed, were hanging out inside the tabernacle, God assigned him, saying, you will guard the gate, guard the entrance, Aaron, and your sons. That is your job, to guard the entrance. Make sure nobody just gets in and out. So while they're there, and anytime they're in there, their job is to guard the entrance. So that was expanded to all the gates of the temple. The Levite's job is to guard the entrance. No one goes in, no one goes out, without, of course, the approval of the high priest or God. So they have a function. And note, there are three groups, but there are a lot of gates. The temple had a whole bunch of them. I think there were 12, if I recall correctly. Three on each side. A whole bunch. And they're big gates. It's not like a little door, like a little 3-foot-wide door. They're large. You can have crates carts going through it if you need to. They're very big. So, and if you imagine what the wash tub that Solomon built with all the steer underneath it, the bulls underneath it, the big bull, exactly. It's enormous. Get that thing through a doorway. Yeah, and you take out your house to get through it. So it's very big. So all the gates are big. They have a lot of guarding to do. So all these three groups are guarded around all the gates. Now, he specifies they're going to be guarded into three different sections. But there is one group that guards the king. Actually, let's read off exactly what they're supposed to guard. It says in a third of those who you are arriving. Oh, I should have written that down. I apologize. There are two groups of Levites that we're dealing with here. There's one group that's arrivals, and one's departing. Changing the guard. So what he did is he said, all right, those who arrive will break into three groups, 1, 2, and 3. Those who are departing will break into just the two groups, 1 and 2. That's your function. These guys normally would leave at the end of the day of Shabbat. Well, these people are arriving at the beginning of the day of Shabbat. So, in the morning until evening, both groups are normally there. That's the important thing. They're normally there every time an exchange happens. So, when you have that many people at temple, normally, and everywhere else in the world, you say, wow, what's going on? Something big event. You would attract attention. But, if this exchange happens on a regular basis, no one's going to care. And since he had extra weapons and spears that David so conveniently placed inside the temple, I wonder why he did that, he was able to outfit both groups with all the soldier weaponry they needed. Why would he want to do all this? He's talking about one lady, right? Kill off one girl. What does it matter? She's been in charge for up to 7 years now. She has loyalists. And that's given to us, actually, in the hint. He hints to that in verse... When he says when she's, in verse 15, when he says take her away, but keep her within the ranks. Amon comes after her, slay her. And in verse 16, they made a place for her, and she came by the way of the horse's gate. So they actually opened a little space for her, put her between all the men, and then surrounded her. Kept her hiding inside the ranks. We'll discuss why in a minute. So we have arrival and departures. Everybody's armed. There's men stationed at... Where is it? A third of the circuit, a third station behind the infantry. Who's the infantry? So we have a third at the circuit. Go back to verse 5. A third of those places where they'll be watched the king's palace, a third station at the surgate, and a third will be stationed behind the infantry. Those are all these groups arrived. So one watches the king's palace, one is at the surgate, and one is behind the infantry. Of these two departing groups, he specifies they are broken up after he discusses the ones by the infantry. The other two groups, verse 7, will be joined by all those who are leaving on the Shabbat. They shall keep guard of the temple of the Lord for the king. The other two groups here, they are joining those two groups to guard the king. Because this one's the palace, the king's palace. These two groups join these two. So we have one and two of arrival and one and two departing, which is broken up to half. They're here. So we have a very large number of men surrounding the king and the surrogate. So who's the infantry? Well, it's the infantry's gate. The infantry, as it points out when it grabbed the chiefs of fathers in verse 2 of chapter 23 of 2 Chronicles, beat chief fathers of Israel and they came to Jerusalem. Well, when that exchange happened, who else showed up other than just the Levites? The chief fathers did. Are they Levites? Not necessarily. They could be, but they're probably Judah's descendants. So who are the infantry? We would call them the army. Who are loyal to chief fathers or their command? So they are hanging out with the infantry. So these groups are all broken up this particular way. Ask yourself why. Good question. Why? I'll leave this up for a minute, actually. Change colors, too. So what's the point of all this? The whole chapter seems to go into a lot of extensive detail about this child and getting him through from the temple to the king's palace in a clean or protected manner. There's a lot of effort that God spent in 2 Kings to make sure this was well-documented and detailed. Does God document things really well for the fun of it because he's bored? No. So if it's something God's going to spend the effort to document, there's probably a really good reason why. Let's discuss why. Now I don't need this. I'm going to erase it now. Who is this child? He is a messianic figure. He's not actually the Messiah, but he's a messianic figure. Throughout your Bible, over and over and over again, you read about individual people, Solomon, David, whoever, it doesn't matter who they are. They all exhibit a messianic style of behavior, the good ones, not Ahab. That is a shadow of things to come, a symbolic way of saying, when the Messiah does come, he's going to look like this person. He's going to look like that person. He's going to look like this person. Everybody heard of Samson, right? In his death, he will save Israel as the prophecy is given to him. Of course, he dies, he saves Israel. So they're all not just him. Many of them are messianic figures throughout the law. All of them. So we have this bunch of events around this six to seven-year-old son, a boy. Because there's something unique about him. Let's look a little bit into him. I'm accelerating this because I'm running late on time, so forgive me. I'm going past a few extra verses that... He does have a good beginning. Yeah, right, DNA. See here. Okay. He was born. Is he a descendant of Ahab? Yes. Yes, technically. Ahaziah, all the whole life. He's also the only surviving royal heir of David. Now, he's not the only descendant of David, but he's a surviving royal heir. There's a difference. You know what the difference is? David had a lot of kids. They all had children. And none of them have right to the throne except the one through Solomon. Solomon had a lot of kids. And they had children. None of them had a right to the throne except the one through Rehoboam. Get the picture? There are a lot of people who are biological descendants of the kings. Daughters, sons, great-grandchildren, cousins, whatever. They're all over the place. But only one was allowed to have the royal heir of the throne, was supposed to go through that particular line. It's no different than the high priest. The high priest is the son, it's a particular son that goes through the high priesthood. That's how it's supposed to work. Not just anybody, but certain particular ones. So the king's line is no different. So there were a lot of other descendants of David that weren't killed by Athaliah. She killed the royal throne. Anyone who was alive deserved the royal throne. And God agreed to David to not wipe out his royal line. That was his agreement. God doesn't break his promises. Yes. Right. So how does he do this? He tricks you. I'll show you how he tricks you. I like this diagram, so forgive me if you guys get bored with it. I have a tree. Branches. It has leaves. God says, you know what, David, we're going to pretend this branch here is David, so we'll put a D on it. David, your line's pretty good. You have a lot of little branches, little twigs all over the place, some big, some bad, you know. We won't discuss Amnon and Absalom, but there's some good, some bad, some bad ones. All right. David, by the way, this branch over here is rotten. Over here, Ian, R-O-T-E-N. Yeah, Ian. Two T's, thank you. Bad spelling. This is rotten. And these happen to have all your existing royal heirs on it. And because the reason it's rotten, because Ahab, little A there, joined your group. He was, quote, blended in, grafted on. I don't really care. No, he was joined on. So God says, David, I had to cut this line off. Terribly sorry. But this line's no good anymore. So I'm going to erase it. And David could argue, but God, you said there wouldn't be a single person. There'd be at least one man. And God said, you're right, because there's a small little twig I'm going to leave. I'm going to say it's a small twig because does that infant child know anything when he's hidden? Does he have any knowledge of why he's hidden? Does he have any knowledge of who his father is? Mother? What? He has a nursemaid. He doesn't know his mom. He has no knowledge of anybody. This little child, this little boy, has no knowledge of any of that. He's literally starting out clean. Does God hold the children responsible for the father's sins? He said he wouldn't. He doesn't hold the children responsible for the father's sins. We'll discuss that in Josiah's son has this dilemma. He discussed this because Josiah is killed later on. He does not pay the children for the father's sins. So, now, by the way, all the lines of Ahab, there's a lot of rotten people in it. So when I said the branch is rotten, I mean all that's rotten. This twig's rotten, so is that one, so is this one, so is that one. They're all rotten. They're rotten individuals. If you read about Ahab, recall the details of him and all of his descendants, they're horrible people. So the loss of them is not such a big deal. Good riddance. But since God agreed to his agreement to David a long time ago, God leaves a small twig. He's cutting it at, I guess you call it the armpit or the weak spot of the branch. But he lets a small little... Have you ever cut down a tree before or cut down a branch and little suckers come up? Yeah, that's what we call it. A little sucker on the end. He left one. But not just one. He could have left a 20-year-old son. He could have left a 15-year-old son. He didn't. He left an infant. And then what did he do with the infant? He said, infant, I'm going to take you off of this branch. I'm going to bring you over to my house over here. And I'm going to replant you. And you little leaves growing. What house was this? The temple. He was literally taken out of the palace, isolated from everyone, and re-educated from ground zero. So what is he? Still a descendant of David. All the rotten individuals of Ahab were killed, and his, quote, rottenness was replanted with better roots. So God kept his promise to David, and he exterminated the problem with Ahab all at the same time. All through a woman named Athaliah. and a man named Jehu. Smart God. He's very good at talent at doing this. We're not quite done yet. So that's how he did it. So I'm going to erase this little tree because I don't need it anymore. So this little branch, I'll put a little leaf here with a little stem in ground. This little twig, a little branch, you could argue whatever it is, made a difference. He is raised in God's house. He is anointed king in God's house.
King.
Was he anointed king anywhere else? By the way, the other kings, where are they anointed king at? Well, all over the place. Some were anointed in the palaces, most common. A few were in God's temple or near the area. Solomon was not actually in the temple, but he was anointed by the high priest. The various anointed, but this particular one is anointed in God's house. He was anointed, of course, by God's priest. Yeah, usually God used prophets. You know, of all the kings in northern Israel, who gets to anoint the king? The prophets do. The priests don't, because the house of Judah obeys the priesthood line, not the prophet line. There's a distinction in how the two houses think, how they process each other. So, priest, God's priest gets to anoint him, unlike Israel. The people who obey or believe or follow God, they support him. People support. Not the rulership, meaning not the queen, not the ones who are in charge of the country. They don't support. The people do. And these people have a particular type of support because they support in God's word by they swore to it. S-W, is it A-R? Oh, thank you. They spelled swore. They swore and they used God's name to do it. So the people are all in, basically, what I'm using this term very loosely, but the point is the people obeyed God by swearing to him. So they're God's people are being obeying this. We're not done yet. This gets a little more. His first task as king, which we haven't gotten there, chapter 12, the first job of this new king is to fix God's house. And that's his exercise. He tells everybody, hey, we're going to clean this house, make all the repairs, and blah, blah, blah that happens to it. But the first job of the people, when they first support him, they go off and remove the competitors to God, or Baal. Because they have agreed via a covenant to follow. Let's see. A man raised in God's house, anointed by king in God's house, by the priests of God, with the people of God supporting him. And he repairs God's house, and he orders the removal of those who are not God. What does it sound like? A Messiah! That's what it sounds like. That's what it's supposed to be like. That Jeremiah does this. That's why he discusses these men. Well, not just the particular men, but the whole process. This boy, I'm not saying he is the Messiah. He is a messianic figure, which means he's acting out things in his life that are Messiah-like. So when the Messiah or a man or a person does these things in your life or whatever future may be, you will say, hey, I've seen this before, thus I will now recognize and I know who you, the real Messiah, actually are. Because I've seen this before in other individuals. And here is an example of a young boy who you would see. And note the number 7 is listed a couple times. Yes.
In fact, even if he had not been noticed as Messiah, for the technical information, the fact that he was cleaning things up,
started in God's house first.
Yeah.
God's house, God cleans up his own house, own people first. They didn't do everybody else. Yes, Louise. Yes. Joash, yes. So what's the point of the chapter? Why did God spend so much detail discussing all this? So we would know what Messiah does when he shows up. Now, I have a question for you. Was Messiah raised in God's house? He actually kind of was, because he was literally started in God through Mary. He was raised up and followed exactly what God told him to do. He's not physically structured inside of a building of God, but he still followed God's house because he was educated as God would be educated. He's being raised.
Right.
Messiah has done some of these things. Is Messiah the current king? Yes, he is. He's been anointed king. Was he anointed by God? The priest of God. Priest is actually a human being. But did God anoint Messiah as king? Well, yeah, he said so. You're king. That's pretty good. Does he get the support of the people today? He did. Messiah was on the light, alive on the earth. The individual people supported him. Did the leadership support him? Not at all. Did the Thalia support Joash? No, not at all. So, he gets all that. Does Messiah, is his first job to clean up God's house? Yes, it is. Now, is he cleaning it? Yes, he is. Is he removing Baal? Has he finished it yet? No. I bring this out to you because he's in the process. It's because in our manner of speaking, if you wish to argue this, we are transitioning in the king's lives, continuing to do so, from Messiah's first arrival, moving into his second. The prophecies that are building up in Isaiah and onward through some of these kings as they move on, we're leaving the details of the early prophets who are focused almost exclusively on Messiah's first coming. Trying to tell people to recognize when he first shows up. We're moving into the later prophets as we go through Kings. And they're less, although they talk about it too, less focused about his arrival in the early part of his work, and more focused on the latter part of his work. They spend more of their time talking about what Messiah does in his second coming than the early prophets who focus on his first coming. And each king, each chapter you read across, and each prophet we discuss, they're going through this process. We're reading into the changes. As you recall in 1 Samuel? I forgot. When Absalom's chasing David, the entire story is perfectly mapped out to match Messiah's entire existence while he was on earth, up to the point of his death. Then it stops. We went through a topic in Samuel. And the story moves on to the other topics to repeat. Well, you can only repeat so many times, but you have to tell something new. Well, now we're going through Kings, we're now moving on to something new. We're going to start cleaning up. Cleaning house. Fixing these problems that are not being fixed by themselves. Now, unfortunately, Josiah is a human being. So he's not perfect. Matter of fact, he turns pretty awful toward the end of his life. But at this point in the story, in 2 Kings, where God spends so much time detailing out how this man is moved from God's house to the kingship of the palace, is to us recall or note that God's going to redo this the same way again. Because our Messiah, he's anointed God's king, but he has not taken the ownership of the earth yet. Have you noticed that? So how does he get from God's house to own the earth? Well, he has to go through this process. He has to go through it. All of them. That's the point. All these individuals, that's who they are. They're sons of God. All these people who are all helping him are all sons of God. They're not necessarily the ones in charge, not the ones at the very bottom, but they're all sons of God. That's their job, and they're helping him move from God's house, up in heaven, you could argue, resurrection, down to take over the earth as a throne, as the king's palace. So, that makes sense? So we're witnessing this event in a man's, a little boy's life, 7-year-old. We're going to see it again a few kings from now. Say it again? We're seeing it. You see it in your current lives as you watch what the earth does and it moves its progression along the path it's traveling and what God's doing in our current modern-day lives. The same process is still occurring. God is transferring slowly, we argue slowly, maybe his time you think it's fast, slowly transferring Messiah's ownership or his kingship out of God's house and put him over king over the earth, as he's supposed to be. But it's a slow process, and it takes a whole lot of men to do it. All the Levites, all the Levites, and all the, quote, chiefs, the fathers, and the descendants, those who are loyal to him and not to the man or woman in charge. Yes?
But you also see a name change here, because in the earlier part of the chapter, the young boy is referred to as Joash, but then 2 Kings 11:21, it says Jehoash was 7 years old when he became king.
Good catch. I was not intending to discuss that because that is my chapter 12 that changed his name. But your chapter 11 still discusses his name change. He changes his name. Exactly. He changes who he is. A name that no man knows. Ever heard that term before? That's the point. He gets his name changed. When he goes from this point to down here, remove Baal, take over the kingship. He's now transferred over to, he's on his throne. He gets his new name. A new title. A new identity. Sounds familiar? It should, those who believe in Messiah. That's the point. So we're seeing God's handiwork ahead of time. Now, Jehoash actually has God's full name in it, Yehoah, but still, it actually is a person of God. So it's an important point in this boy's life or existence that we're supposed to be seeing and observing and watching. So we should expect to see the same thing when our Messiah shows up. He's going to come by a different name once he becomes king. Whatever name it is, I don't know, it's God's choice. But that was the name he gets go by. So, for those of you, no offense, I'm not trying to be mean, who say, well, God's name, Messiah's name is Yeshua, Messiah's name is Jesus, but what? Who cares? The point is, when he shows up, that name doesn't mean anything anymore. He gets a new one. One that you didn't know and one I didn't know. Whatever it may be, it's God's choice, but that's the name we'll know. So, that's a minor detail, in my mind. Because the identity will change. Yes.
Again, as I've mentioned in the past about the quote-unquote name, how you pronounce it, it's going to be the reputation that's going to be familiar.
Right. It's the identity of what the person does is what they are, not their name. What your actions count, as Hannah pointed out in Samuel's mom, actions are weighed by God. Your actions are what matters. Not your intention, not your thoughts, although thoughts are important. Your actions, what you do, that's what matters. That is your name. That's your identity. Make sense? Any questions?
I remember as a kid learning in school that they said, you know, a man's known by his reputation. And when you're really young, you don't really know what that means. I mean, you cause a load of trouble. I think for myself, I'm speaking for myself. And then I think now that I've come in the kingdom and I see and I think, oh my God, what a mess I've made. And can that be, that reputation, now can I undo and walk in that? But your family and friends don't let you sometimes. But now that reputation, because a man is known by his reputation, I see while you're explaining this how important that is.
It is important. It is important. He will erase you.